It's the Dearly Departed Podcast, featuring your host, historian Scott Michaels, and filmmaker Mike Dorsey.
And welcome to episode 16, Scott.
16, magic number, right? Mm-hmm.
16. It's kind of amazing. It's been over a year now that we've been doing this show.
And we've only done 16
episodes.
How lazy. No, it's not true. No, we are.
That's we should awesome. Have done 52 by now, Scott.
It does feel like sometimes we've done that many because of the... I get people all the time coming up to me saying, what a great podcast. I'm thinking, we're just sitting around and
shooting
talking.
Shooting the shit.
And we've done it 16 times and people, like, lots and lots of people listen. It's really awesome.
Yeah, thank you, everybody. And, as always, please share the podcast online if you like us. Your friends and family probably will, too.
Please do. And also, don't hesitate to send in suggestions, too, because...
We love that.
Yeah, we do. And we listen to them, and we've done it. We've used people's suggestions. I think this is one of them today that we'll be working on.
Today is one, and I think the next one we're going to do, which is preview, I think we're going to do SNL, was also an online suggestion.
The Poltergeist one was, too. Yeah, so keep the suggestions coming, please.
Absolutely. It's less work for us. So,
news of the week.
Not too many deaths since we last did this a month ago, but one really big one. Rush, Neil Peart, also sometimes pronounced Neil Peart, the drummer, the rock god and lyricist for Rush, dead on January 7th from brain cancer at the age of 67. Really is one of those deaths that rocked the rock world. And, led to a lot of outpouring of, tributes and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I saw a joke online that all these bands...
Speaking of funny stories. Yeah,
there was a joke online that said joking about all the bands trying to find a quote-unquote easy-to-play Rush song to play in their concert as a tribute to Neil. So Rush, definitely one of the more technically complex rock bands in history.
You ever see that... That video with those guys playing to them, the Guitar Hero, their own songs, and they can't do it.
Oh, really?
Rush is actually doing their own songs on Guitar Hero and can't do it.
Yeah, but those Guitar Hero kids can't play Rush on a real guitar either, so.
Well, God bless him. I know a lot of people were really affected by him, so so that's he left a legacy, most definitely.
And that somewhat forgettable comedy, I Love You, Man, with...
Paul Rudd.
Paul Rudd and Jason Segel.
Yeah.
That's the thing that the main thing they bond over is they are huge Rush fans and they jam out to it in the movie a lot. And I think that they really are in real life. Those
are
actors.
They Canadians or is Paul Rudd Canadian?
He might be.
That would make a big
difference. He seems Canadian.
There's a pride in being Canuck.
He's definitely Canuckish.
Yeah.
But maybe he's not. See, we don't know everything. So I'm actually looking it up on my phone right now as proof that we, don't know every single thing about every single thing. Uh-oh. Nope, he's from Jersey.
Okay.
Sorry.
But he's an honorary Canuck.
All right. Make him an honorary Canadian. Another big name in Hollywood, mainly for one screenplay, Buck Henry, who wrote The Graduate. Obviously, had a long career and did other things. He was appeared on early years of SNL, and he helped create Get Smart with Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
And if you look at IMDb, he still gets a credit for, the Get Smart movies, which they supposedly they're making a second one now with, Steve Carell. So he still gets credit for that, for helping create those characters.
Yeah, he was influential on SNL. Buck Henry, he was a big deal, but never often in front of the screen.
Right. He seems like he was kind of like a joke TV writer early on in his career, too, before The Graduate. That's kind of where he started working
sort of
for
Steve
TV
Martin
shows.
School of, actually, literally, I think they worked together, quite a bit at the early. Get Smart, I think. Wasn't Steve Martin an important part of Get Smart, too? Was he a gag writer for that?
I don't know.
Fuck, I hate thinking out loud. We just shut up.
Publicly on the air.
Poor Buck Henry. R.I.P.
We're just like butchering his career here. Like, did he do that?
I know. People
he was
are,
not in it. No.
Yeah, right.
People are going to hate it. But anyways, look, rest in peace, Buck Henry, 89, a legend, even if we fuck up his resume. And rest in peace, Buck Henry.
89 years old.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good age to make it to, I think.
That's
And that's kind of it for like the big. I would say the big names, but there's more. There's more names. Okay. I'm just saying that's it for like the big names.
Okay.
We also lost George Michael's sister. Her name is Melanie Paniatu, and she died exactly 3 years to the day after her brother George Michael died on Christmas Day, just like he did, exactly 3 years later. At the age of 59, the family is not giving a cause of death. It's not considered suspicious. I consider the timing suspicious, though, so I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know.
Seems like a big coincidence. Any thoughts on that?
You know, no. Okay. It's the only thing that makes it interesting is there was an estate.
Oh, right.
Her brother's estate. I don't belittle her relationship, but it seems like such a mess, that family. Mm. His boyfriend, his family life, whatever. It just seems such a mess.
Mm-hmm.
And if he wasn't filthy rich and famous, we wouldn't be talking about him.
Right. Shock jock Don Imus, dead at 79 on December 27th from what was just called lung disease, which seems vague. He's a controversial figure, obviously. Stan Kirsch, an actor on Highlander, suicide at 51. Had not had an IMDb credit in about 11 years, but he was working as an acting coach on some pretty high-profile stuff. I think he worked with Adam Levine on something as an acting coach, so I think that's kind of what he had switched to.
How do you do that?
Become an acting coach?
Well, if you're an actor and not very good at it, and obviously, you know, how do you get a job teaching?
Not necessarily acting. Not good at it, just eventually you're not commercially successful. I know several actors who had success early in their careers, and then they just kind of, it fizzles out, or they age out or whatever, and they were making a living at it, they can't make a living anymore, so now they teach it. Mm-hmm. So that's generally what happens.
Okay.
And it kind of helps with their income, I guess. Some of them are still working, you know, in the acting, teaching acting kind of fills in the gaps for them, you know, to get by.
Okay. I didn't mean that to be belittling. I was just genuinely curious.
How dare you insult the acting community?
Yeah, no, I don't.
Yeah. Here's a crazy story. Okay, so I know you posted about this, Scott. So there's a show, a reality show called My Big Fat Gypsy Wedding.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's in the UK. And there were twin brothers that were on the show. I think they were landscapers, and they got kind of unexpectedly famous from being on the show. They're twin brothers, Billy and Joe Smith. They were 32 years old, and they basically did a suicide pact and hung themselves. Rumor is from a tree in England a few weeks ago, and one person, I think someone out there is claiming that one of them got a cancer diagnosis and they had depression and the other one couldn't live without the other one, and so that's what they did. But you posted this and we're like, this must be a hell of a story behind this, and I guess that's the story.
Yeah, they weren't releasing any details. And yeah, those people, because they were good-looking guys, and good-looking twins are like lightning in a bottle if they're going to be on television.
Sure,
you know?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, getting a diagnosis, and twins have that unexplainable bond anyway between them, and that must have been a hell of a thing for the family. My God, what they left behind, that's just so awful.
What else do you have?
Oh, I don't have anything.
Oh. You seem so disappointed.
No,
when I was
kind of out
of names.
No, because I know there were some biggies, but I just figured you'd...
I've got there's another one that I want to, only because I want to talk about this to prove a point. So this was mentioned on your Dearly Departed Facebook page. This actor named Harry Haynes, who American Horror Story and The OA, dead at 27. So here's the thing that I've noticed happens a lot. So this guy's like, he's known, the media reports where he's known for American Horror Story and The OA. So I looked him up, and you know, he was in a single episode of American Horror Story 5 years ago. His character name was Boy. So I'm not saying this to belittle his career. I'm saying this is a recurring thing I've noticed really in the past year with the media. They'll say, you know, Star Trek actor dead at 87, and you look up and it's like, yeah, he was a featured extra in one episode 50 years ago. And it's like it's just an excuse to write a story about some random person who really just did extra work.
Yeah, and
in
a lot
movies,
of music,
and it's like he was known for, and I bet the people that worked on that show are like, who?
Yeah.
No,
the people of the media picked up on it. Probably maybe it's just better to put a death with a face that
I
we
guess,
can say,
but
I may have seen that.
It's just a little weird that what every extra actor, I mean, there's millions of them out there that have appeared in things just randomly.
I agree.
It seems like an odd thing lately.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess they're starving for content.
Like you're saying, not belittling it, but it is like a little bit over the top.
And I see it a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's the day of TMZ. You know,
right.
It's like every guy that's ever done a rap record, you know, ever in life is going to make a headline on TMZ if they die or something happens to them. Every guy, every girl, every whatever.
I know.
Anyone that has any kind of show business aspiration, some sort of work that you can pull up on the internet and show for it, they'll make it into a story because all they want is the hits.
I'm pretty on top of things, and when I occasionally go to TMZ, like 9 out of 10 names they write about, I have no idea who they're talking about.
And that's,
part of I don't watch reality TV, and a lot of stuff they write about is people that are on reality shows, but. Yeah, I think also there's so much to watch now that it's impossible to see it all.
I agree. It's exhausting. I mean, I was looking at the nominations for the Academy Awards. Like, I'm never going to see this, ever. Oh, my God. This is like, it's not even, so there's too many choices, too many networks, and it's just like, you just want to jerk off.
Just want to jerk off. I'm just going to drink and jerk it.
It's like, it's so much easier.
I vote on the Producers Guild Awards every year because I'm in the Producers Guild of America, and so I have to watch as much as I can.
Yeah,
but
there are
every year there's a few categories because you can abstain from some categories. So like sports programming, I mean, I watch sports. I don't watch commentary on sports. So I don't vote on that category, and I don't usually vote on the kids programming because I don't have any kids, so I don't know what's cool with the kids today.
Right.
But but I do make it a point to always watch all of the nominated films for the main award, which there's usually like 10 of them.
Right.
It usually comes down to the wire, and I finally see them. But the coolest thing was I just saw Little Women two nights ago, and Greta Gerwig was there to do Q&A afterwards, and it was. Through the guild, you get to go to a lot of those types of screenings. All the different guilds do these.
Yeah.
They all, like, SAC
do you have
has
to
the,
attend
SAC has their own, you don't have to.
Okay.
It's just it's a perk.
Yeah,
really.
Sure.
Because they send you the screeners to your house. So I have Little Women on DVD. I could watch it here if I wanted to. But then when I saw the interview, the screening invite, I was like, oh, well, that's even better.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Little Women is really good. And all the movies this year were great. I mean, the movie that I ranked like 9th out of the 10 was Ford versus Ferrari, and I freaking love that movie.
Really?
So that just shows you how strong, you know, the field was this year. It was a really good year for movies. So
there's a lot of choices out there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of choices.
So
we also Ed Byrne died, who was the guy that he played Vince Fontaine in Grease.
Oh, okay.
He was the announcer. He was also in the whole kooky lend me your comb thing in the 50s. That was down to him. That was a song. It was a hit song, and it had to do with 77 Sunset Strip, the TV show,
which was not a real address.
His name was Ed Burns, Ed Kooky Burns. And so that was, it was a novelty song in the 50s.
Interesting.
And but yeah, most people know him from Grease. And if you get a chance to see, there's somebody I saw isolated this, it was on Facebook, and it's probably an easy find. There's a moment in the finale of the high school dance in Grease where they're doing the whole, you know, it's the big dance. They all end up in one big pose at the end of it, you know, with one dead stop.
Jazz hands.
There's this thing what he does to enter the scene. He does a backflip from the side. He comes in the middle of it. There's a whole crew of people. He's got to have this down to the second. He does a backflip just as he's about to land, grabs a microphone that has been thrown to him that is on a cord and stops right in the center and does one of these ta-da things.
Uh-huh.
You got to see somebody isolated the second it's on a GIF, and it's like you watch it. He's just missing people's faces with his flip and this microphone. The timing had to be right on there. It's spectacular. It really is. That was I've never seen anything like it. I couldn't, you know, I've seen the movie 1,000 times, but when you actually see this see it actually happening, it's pretty incredible.
Also, if you guys haven't seen it yet, there's a great series, limited series on Netflix called The Movies That Made Us, which is, I think, connected to another good series they have there called The Toys That Made Us. And The Movies That Made Us is basically a series, it was like 3 or 4 behind-the-scenes documentaries, you know, new ones. So they did Ghostbusters for this first one. They did Ghostbusters, Dirty Dancing, and
Grease,
Home Alone.
Home Alone?
And Die Hard. Yeah. It was really fascinating.
Movies that made us.
It was movies that made. I mean, it's obviously aimed at kind of a millennial or X.
No, but
or
I mean,
X.
How? In what regard are they making?
I don't
you
know. I guess they're just big movies
become that, part of pop culture.
That's the thing. Yeah, the thing. These were pop culture iconic movies that in.
I see.
And also a lot of them, like, you know, Home Alone and Dirty Dancing were both underdog movies. They weren't expected to do anything, and they both became classics. You mm-hmm. know, so I think that probably has something to do with it. But some interesting things. One thing that I thought was interesting was that. When Bruce Willis was cast in Die Hard, everybody laughed at it because
really?
He was the moonlighting guy. It was like, that's not, he's not a tough guy. Like, and they said audiences when they first saw the trailers for it laughed like at it, not with it.
Interesting.
to see Bruce Willis cast as an action star. And it was completely
going into the Schwarzenegger, mm-hmm. Stallone, genre.
And I think they kind of took him off the advertising at a certain point and focused more on the building.
Really?
You know, the skyscraper.
Yeah.
You know?
Nakatomi Plaza.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So that's for that reason, you know.
Well, you know, that's considered a Christmas movie.
Yeah.
I just never put that together.
It's an internet debate. I guess if a movie takes place during Christmas, people want to make it a Christmas movie, I guess.
Okay. It's up there. It's like people do watch it as a tradition. And they're like, all right. Okay.
And I thought the Home Alone one was really interesting because they took over a high school.
And that's very
like
Christmassy.
Bandit.
That's very
That's
Christmassy.
An obvious Christmas movie. Yeah. Exactly. And then the other part that I thought was interesting was the Dirty Dancing. I did not know that Jennifer Grey and Patrick Swayze did not get along.
No, neither did I.
And they were, you know, they, of course, they're supposed to have all this romantic chemistry.
Those are sometimes the best, right?
I think
they?
He was, it was kind of an opposites kind of a thing.
Because
he was very professional and
Bruce Willis
strict,
and Cybill Shepherd was the same thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they detested each other. So I didn't know that about Jennifer Grey and Patrick Swayze.
Nope. Because she, you know, well, she wasn't a dancer, and he was. He was a trained dancer.
Mm-hmm.
And so the dance scenes, it was tougher for her. So he kept kind of getting mad when she would screw up. And she would also get, you know, the giggles during certain scenes, and he's trying to be serious and do the scene, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he also, his knee was completely ruined from football in high school, and he had to do, you know, in the finale scene with the big dance in front of everybody, he has to do that big leap off the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And he really did that, and he did it, and he did it, and he did it, and then finally he came over to the director, and he's like, you got to get it on the next shot, because I can't do it again with my, you know, I'm in pain.
Mm-hmm.
And so just tell everybody to get it this time.
Mm-hmm.
And they did. They got it. So, yeah. And then he had to do, the famous lift with her where she runs and jumps up and he holds her over his head.
Mm-hmm.
Which was, yeah. Anyways, so yeah. Movies That Made Us. Really good on Netflix. There was a random story about Jack Nicholson's health put out by his grandson, who's an actor now as well, which I thought was kind of funny. It read to me like kind of a PR piece. Like somebody representing the grandson wanting to get his name out there.
Does the grandson do anything?
Because he's an actor.
Is he got a project?
I think he's been in some stuff. I think he has been in some stuff, but it felt like nobody was asking for this information. Like, don't worry, Jack Nicholson's health is fine. It's like, who was worried about it?
Now we are.
Now we're worried about it. Yeah, why are you saying that?
Yeah.
I could be wrong. I don't know what the deal was, why that came out. And then Brittany Murphy's half-brother did a new interview.
Sorry, that's not funny.
He thinks she was murdered.
Go figure.
Of course. And Brittany Murphy's half-brother is somehow 70 years old.
Can we
old.
Talk about that? Yeah, Angelo's dead now. We can talk about
this.
Yeah,
he's 90. Yeah, because he died at 92.
Okay,
had
so...
strokes and stuff. Well, that's the dad.
We did Death Trip, Hollywood Death Trip for E! And
we did a Brittany Murphy section.
Right. Yep. And we went up there and to the house when it was being torn down. And it was myself and Danielle Harris, who were the hosts of this show.
Danielle Harris of Halloween franchise.
Right. The the last girl, I think they call her.
The final girl. The final
new,
girl. Yeah,
final
yeah,
girl.
Yeah, yeah.
So Danielle and I are talking to Angelo, the father, Brittany Murphy's father. And this is devastating. He comes out of the car, and he's got baby pictures, and he's got baby booties, and he's got these little daddy drawings that she made. And I'm, like, already really upset going up there because I knew we were going to have to play that 911 call, even though I didn't want to do it. And I begged the producers, let's not play that call.
It's so brutal.
But they demanded that we do it. And so we had to sit and play this thing and listen to it in front of that house. It was awful, awful, awful. But anyway,
I read the article, the new interview, and the son claims that Monjack, the husband, had debts.
Oh, sure.
With six-figure debts,
sure.
And that's, of course, what... It's the same thing they tried to say about the publicist that got killed in Beverly
Ronnie
Hills.
Ronnie Chasen, yeah.
Same thing. Oh, her brother had gambling debts, and I was like, whatever.
People are scrambling for alibis, But so, not a well-liked guy, and a user, a complete user, Simon Monjack was, and married her for citizenship. I mean, that's just... plain obvious.
Yeah, she supposedly hinted at that.
But then we
that
were talking
to
those other guys that we interviewed. Remember at the Dresden Room? Those two that were going on about the the helicopters and the government, the secret immigration. Oh my God!
She had pneumonia.
I know. But
what,
there's
they shoot her with a pneumonia
government
gun.
Like conspiracy. They didn't even use those interviews. That was so bad. Oh my God! I were dying.
So the brother is basically saying somebody killed her, and he's basically like, who's getting the money from her?
From her estate?
Find out who that is. And for the record, I don't believe she was murdered, obviously. She got sick. And she was in bad health to begin with.
I mean, there's a lot of, there's just unusual situations lead for speculation.
Right. A weird deaths like that, people want to make it out to be
someone
else.
Young and you don't expect them to die.
Right.
And people can't really come to grips with it.
But weird stuff happens. And, then the husband dies, a month or two later from the same thing. And it's like, oh, what's going on here? Shit happens. Anyways, I had a Jimmy Stewart story, a new one.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it kind of goes in line with what we talked about in our last, the show that we did about It's a Wonderful Life. So I met up with a buddy of mine who's a producer, and he had, I won't say his name for privacy, but he produced one of the big award shows years ago. He was a producer on that, and one of the things he had to do was he had to do outreach to the celebrities that were going to come out and do a special presentation at the award show, and Jimmy Stewart was one of them. So he said, I had to go to Jimmy Stewart's house several times to meet with him, plan out what we were going to do, and he said it was after his wife had died, so Jimmy was kind of alone in the house, and he said he was the kindest gentleman you could ever imagine. He goes, and he always insisted on making him a sandwich whenever he would come over. So I'd sit there and eat lunch with him in his house. And he's like, Jimmy would make me a sandwich. He would insist on it. I would sit there. We'd talk. And he would just tell stories. He loved talking about Hollywood and, the old days and all that stuff. So more proof of what a nice, kind gentleman Jimmy Stewart was.
Decent guy.
What's going on? You're trying to get a grave marker for James Anderson?
The cemetery's been dicking us around. James Anderson was in To Kill a Mockingbird. He was in Little Big Man. He was in a lot of westerns. And every couple of years, we raise the money to donate a headstone or a marker to somebody's grave. Or sometimes we actually buy graves.
Some famous person who's been forgotten about and is buried in an unmarked grave.
Yeah. So Anderson died in 1969. When I was looking over his credits, he had sort of had that Rick Dalton feel to him. From the movie
Once Upon a Time. Yeah.
And so I reached out to the cemetery and I had a meeting with them, and I bought the stone, and this is back in August, and I bought the stone personally, and then in retrospect had a fundraiser for it to reimburse myself and to pay for the other expenses for when this thing is ultimately marked. There's no profit margin, believe me. I'm not doing it like that. It's not like that. But anyway, so we raised the money, and finally, 5 months later, when it should have been marked already 2 months ago, they finally sent through the final design this week. So it will be hopefully marked in the next couple of months. So it's just been a long, ridiculously lengthy process. But that's what happens when you go through the channels you're supposed to.
Yeah,
if I would have just bought it and put it there myself, it would have been done 2 weeks ago or 2 weeks afterwards.
But. And a lot of times they just have to check to make sure there's no next of kin.
Yeah,
that's what you.
Well,
usually,
that was done when I before run, they got my money.
That's usually what you run into, though. You got to do first is make sure there's no next of kin.
Right.
That would be like, no, wait, who's doing what?
Yeah,
like,
ultimately you have to sign a waiver if anyone does step up. That they can have it removed. It's like,
sure.
Well, that's fine.
Nobody's going to.
Yeah,
so.
And if they do, so what? Then it's your problem.
Right.
But it's for, it's for us. It's for now. It's for them. Mm-hmm. And it's important. So,
And speaking of Once Upon a Time, which we just mentioned, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I got from the most reliable of sources a story, somebody that we know that met somebody on that film who said that who verified that Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio were given copies of the 6 degrees of Helter Skelter and told to watch it.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. With what instructions? I mean, when Tarantino said that this is what we want, I was like, what is it exactly that you want? The nerdy aspect of it?
That's what I was curious about. That's a good point.
The information we had was pretty good and it's more thorough than a lot of them.
Yeah.
But ours was not personality driven. I don't know. But we know for a fact that he likes weirdo nerdy facts, and we're full of that. So
And we know being Tarantino, he went a whole other level with it beyond what we ever did.
But it's funny. So. Yeah. It is cool. Very cool.
You were just in Nashville.
Yeah.
Man, how was that? You went to a bunch of places.
It was great.
You went to the Grand Ole Opry. I know you went out to where Patsy Cline's crash site was again, which I think you'd been to before.
Mm-hmm. This time we went equipped. No, it was cool. We had a really interesting time, and I can just verify that there's still stuff out there.
Is there? Yeah, interesting. Yeah. There's still things. There.
Yeah.
All right.
So you can actually you can say that there's still stuff out there.
Yeah, I don't have to tell you. There is. Yeah, there's still things that could be found.
Yeah.
If you go out there with the correct equipment.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty.
I'm
cool.
Not saying that you did.
No.
No. No. No.
No, that would be not right.
Mm-hmm. But that's according to locals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Local yeah. I mean, stories. It hasn't been
many
built
people
on.
Are saying. Many people are saying.
You know, there's this interview that was. I was listening to before we went over there, and this guy was one of the first people to show up. He's just a local guy,
mm-hmm.
and they heard the plane crash, and he talks. I mean, oh my God, I couldn't believe he was talking. He says her foot was in the tree,
oh,
and
geez.
I went over, and there was her leg was over there, and there was clothes. I mean, this guy was, and he's just sitting in this restaurant talking to this reporter, and the reporter's like ready to puke. But this is in the 90s, early 90s, but it's on YouTube. But this guy's like, oh,
wow.
And, you know, that what was left of her head was over there, and he knew it was her because he could tell by the makeup or the hairstyle or something.
Uh-huh.
And it was just the foot in the tree is the one that got me.
She's saying she fell to pieces.
She literally fell to pieces. Jeez. Two pieces, yeah. So, it's pretty gruesome and
plane
pretty
crashes
wild.
Are bad. How,
yeah. So, yeah, man, Nashville was awesome. We had a great time. The Grand Ole Opry at the Ryman, you know, it was there for the week of Christmas. There was nothing like it. I really loved Nashville. It was good. I don't think we could live there. We were looking at it as a potential place to move to, but we really, really enjoyed it.
That's cool.
And ringing in the new year.
Why don't you think you could live there?
Pardon?
Why couldn't you live there?
Like it's, what? You know, I'm from the Midwest. Troy isn't. Troy's from Southern California.
Yeah.
And it's different, you know, it's gray, it's brown. I know that it's only one season out of the year, but it's pretty cold.
Yeah.
A lot of concrete, not a lot of trees. And I don't know. It just was, I could just tell by the vibe of it that I don't think either of us would necessarily flourish there.
It's nice to visit. I've been before. It's super fun. The country club, the country bars and stuff are cool. The live music is great. You know, like, yeah, it's a fun place.
And we literally,
good barbecue.
We spend New Year's Eve day. In Dollywood. And then we literally rented a...
Which is Dolly Parton's...
Yeah, Dolly's... Like anyone needs clarification. Like, everyone knows what Dollywood is. You're obviously not a homosexual. And it's the happiest place in the world. It is. And don't ever say it isn't. She is our fairy godmother.
Uh-huh. How is that? Why is that? It's kind of like with Judy Garland's the same thing.
No, it's not at all.
It's not.
No.
Don't even put them in the same
sentence. You know, Judy wasn't a songwriter either.
Right.
But, Dolly, I guess it's, what's nice about Dollywood is that it's not overexposure to Dolly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you expect to see her face and hear her voice everywhere. And it's not like that. You know, there are places. There's like a theater and there's this and there's that. And of course in the souvenir shop there's plenty, but she's not, her face and her voice isn't everywhere.
Oh, wow.
So it's sort of you know, it's done tasteful. And it was just wonderful. It was a wonderful little place. It's sort of like Knott's Berry Farm. It's not an intense amusement park. It was just, we went there for about 5 hours and it was perfect. We had a great time. And then we went and sat in our Tennessee mountain home and rang in the new year.
Amazing.
It was. But after we closed the park at 6 or so, and then we went back, we literally rented a Tennessee mountain home. We had to go up these roads that were like cliffs.
Oh, wow.
And got this little cabin on a hill.
Like Airbnb?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And it was an isolated cabin, and it was the sunset, and a jacuzzi on the roof of the Tennessee mountain home was like the best part of the week. You know, Nashville was great, but it's still a city. I didn't realize how much I liked being out, you know, sort of away.
Yeah.
And it was quiet, and it was just the two of us, and it was really nice.
Absolutely.
Had a great time. But love Tennessee.
I got to go to a really cool thing a week or two ago for, it was a Christmas present, our friend Kelly, and we went up there and did the Stahl House.
Oh, fun.
Which is, the Stahl House, if you don't know, is one of the most famous houses, mid-century modern houses in Los Angeles. It's in the Hollywood Hills prime location, like the middle of Hollywood Hills.
Yeah.
And it is one of the most famous homes in L.A., and it's this beautiful, beautiful all-glass mid-century modern house.
You have
with
seen
the pool
that
and,
photograph
and there's
a
the
thousand
famous
million
photo
times,
by,
yeah.
Shulman.
Yeah.
Julia Shulman, who took this great photo of the girl sitting in the corner of the window with the city spread out, you know, at night.
And everybody takes
her.
That picture and should.
Yeah. And I recreated it while I was up there. You have to.
Yeah.
So you can take tours. You can sign up and pay for a ticket and take a tour. tour of the house, and it's really cool. And do it now, because I got the feeling that they might be selling it.
Because it's still in the Stahl family, they still own it.
And they it has been appraised, they could get 20-25 million, maybe even 30, mm-hmm. for that house. And when you consider it's only a 2200 square foot two bedroom mm-hmm. home, that's pretty, you know, two bath home, that's pretty amazing. But it, because of the pedigree of it, you know, it's a Pierre Koenig, it's a case study house, of which there's only a few that exist in Hollywood, in LA, and it's just a phenomenal piece of property.
Yeah, so I've never been. Their tickets are hard to get.
Because you never know. Yeah, you have to, and you get them on their website, and they go on sale once a month, and literally, according to our friend, they sell out within 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So you have to be there on the website ready to go and get them, because like our group only had 14 people in it. Mm-hmm. And the coolest thing about it was, I've done other home tours, like I did the Gamble House in Pasadena, which is amazing.
That's a good one.
But that's a guided, structured, you go together room by room through the house. Stahl House, they just turned you loose. And we just do what you want. You have an hour and a half to hang out here and look around. And at a certain point, the tour guide took us into the living room area and told stories about the house for, you know, 15, 20 minutes and gave you the history. But you didn't have to partake in that if you wanted to. You could just walk around and take pictures on your phone and just... It was really cool to just get to experience the house how you wanted to, mm-hmm. basically, right? And kind of take a seat and take in what the view would have been like. And we went also for the sunset one, which was, so you get to see day turn to night from there and that. Because other ones, some of them were during the daytime, and that mm-hmm. I highly recommend do the sunset tour. Yeah, it was really cool. So, but, you know, when a house sells like that, you never know what the new owners are going to do. And they may not open it up to the public. Like that, so you kind of got to take advantage while you still can.
They
get
a huge tax break for keeping it open, so it would depend how sniffy they are.
And they said, and it's in great condition, and they said that the ticket sales go toward maintaining the house, because they're, you know, houses like that, you're constantly.
It's not that expensive, is it? It's like less than $100, isn't it?
I think it was $50 to $100. Something
it doesn't seem like that expensive
for something really freaking cool. I mean, it's probably the coolest thing I'll do for a year. You know,
it's iconic. If you Google it, there's a thousand people in that location doing that picture because it's so cool.
Yeah. The only other house in L.A. that's mid-century that comes close to that is the Sheets Goldstein House, which is where The Big Lebowski was filmed. It's that really cool angular concrete house. It's where Jackie Treehorn lives, the pornographer, and it's where the dude goes and he drinks a white Russian that's drugged and passes out on the glass coffee table and then wakes up in the street. Yeah. So he that Sheets Goldstein House, and that one is being donated when the owner of it dies, Goldstein. When he passes away, he's already gifted it to, I think, UCLA or USC, one of the big colleges. That one will be open to the public. But with something like Stahl, you don't know who's going to buy it.
Yeah.
So see it while you still can.
It's like the Ennis House, you know, the Lloyd Wright, Frank Lloyd Wright house.
Uh-huh.
That one is, it's selling again.
That's right.
And but that's another one. They, in order to buy it, to get a tax break, to get some sort of funding grant, it has to be open to the public certain days, certain amount of days a year.
And have you done the Hollyhock House yet?
I have, yeah.
That's great. I went on a first date there one time, the opening night of it. We stood in line for 3 hours. Worst first date I could have possibly invited somebody on. I had no idea. But it was kind of like... three hour line to get in, because it was opening night, it was the first time you could see it, so it became like a thing, and they were not totally, it's amazing. Go now, because you don't have to wait 3 hours if you go now.
They're doing a huge renovation of that now too. They're like making the grounds, they're putting the grounds back
around it, because they did a huge renovation of the house itself before they opened it. And the grounds have, it was built by this woman who was ahead of her time. It was built in, I think, the 20s, and she was into theater and arts and everything, and just cool. She was a cool lady, but she hated the house. She did not like the house that he built for her. So she, after a few years, she donated it to the city and the
it
land.
It became like
and
an
land
artist
around it.
Kind of commune.
So there's a theater
sort
up
sort of
there
place.
That they built. They built a theater, and there's a park around it and stuff. It's on a hill. She basically bought her own hill in Los Angeles and built this thing on it. Yeah. So, but now it's open to the public. So Hollyhock House.
It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. I mean, look, I love Frank Lloyd Wright, and I especially love his Mayan Revival houses, of which he only did, I think, 4. And then his son Lloyd Wright did his own Mayan Revival houses, which are also amazing.
And you should talk about your documentary, too, the Euler House.
Yeah, so I did my fascination with architecture is my grandfather, whose name Richard Euler, is my step-grandfather, and he
he built a Richard Neutra house, and Richard Neutra is one of the most famous, mm-hmm. probably in the top five. He's on the Mount Rushmore of mid-century modern architects, mm-hmm. for sure. And he built a house in Lone Pine called the Euler House, named after my grandfather. And so I did a documentary on it.
That's really good.
And it's called The Euler House, Richard Neutra's Desert Retreat. And the actress Kelly Lynch and screenwriter Mitch Glazer own it now, and they've owned it now for over 20 years. They've owned it since the late 90s.
Now, didn't she have an architecturally significant house here in L.A.?
Yes. So they also own a John Lautner house, which Lautner was the same architect that did the Sheets Goldstein house. And they own an amazing John Lautner house in the Hollywood Hills, and that's their main residence. Mm-hmm. And then the Lone Pine one, the Neutra one, is their retreat, you know, their kind of retreat. And her husband goes there to write work and write things, and it's just great creative. Because it's out in the desert. It's out in the country. So it's really cool. But
cool stuff.
So check it out. The Euler House, Richard Neutra's Desert Retreat.
How do you spell Euler House?
O-Y-L-E-R.
Yeah.
O-Y-L-E-R, Euler. And Neutra is N-E-U-T-R-A. It looks like Neutra.
Neutrogena.
It looks like Neutra, but it's Neutra. Yeah. N-E-U-T-R-A. But yeah, the Euler House is on. I mean, I think you can still get it on Amazon and some other places. Yeah, it's out there.
Cool.
So I had some news. I was in... So I did the documentary Murder Rap, Inside the Biggie and Tupac Murders, which basically presented all the evidence that the police have known for years now, who killed Tupac and who killed Biggie, but haven't filed charges. And that became the series Unsolved, with Josh Duhamel and Jimmy Simpson on USA Network, which is now on Netflix, which I ended up co-producing as well. And so I have kind of stuck with that story. And basically, a couple years ago, the main kind of guy that confessed to his crew or his friends being the ones that were involved with Tupac's murder and claimed he was in the shooter's car, he keeps doing these interviews, and he put a book out and all this stuff. So I reached out to Las Vegas police because I really think the case should be cleared. I think if law enforcement knows who did it, they should at least clear the case. And in this case, the shooter is dead. He was killed himself about a year and a half after he allegedly shot Tupac. But if you call Vegas police, they'll tell you it's still an unsolved case, and they don't comment on unsolved cases. And it's like, well, it's not really unsolved. They know who did it. And so there's a term in police called cleared other. It's basically when they know who did something, who did a crime, but prosecution isn't possible a lot of times because the person's dead. They don't continue to act like they don't know what happened. They clear the case. They'd be like, look, we know who did it. We can't prosecute anybody for it, but we consider the case closed. And for whatever reason, I guess because it's such a famous case, they won't do that with Tupac's murder. So I've been lobbying for the past like 2 years. I've even met with the detectives in Vegas that are currently the lead, you know, the leads on that case there, trying to get them to just clear the case, man, close it out. And so I got a couple of big articles in the UK tabloids this past week. It started in The Sun, and now today it's in the Daily Mirror, and all about, you know, my effort to make this happen and mm-hmm. pointing out all the evidence that exists that mm-hmm. that doesn't seem to be making a dent for whatever reason. So I'm still hopeful.
You sort of exonerate Suge Knight, don't you?
For Tupac's murder, 100%. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Suge was basically a backstop to all the bullets that were fired that killed Tupac, and he was twice the size of Tupac. So the idea that he would have been like, yeah, I'm going to sit right next to the guy while you spray my entire car with bullets and just hope you don't kill me. Mm-hmm. And he was hit by shrapnel or something in the back of his head. So he didn't come out of it unwounded, and that, you know, could have easily killed him. So no, Suge had nothing to do with it. And they were, you know, Tupac, I think, was going to go his separate ways, but he was going to continue to distribute through death row. So everybody was on great terms as far as I know. So yeah.
Hmm.
No, Suge definitely had nothing to do with it. It was a gang dispute. It was a dispute with a gang that Death Row Records themselves, because they were aligned with the Bloods, and it was a Crip gang in Compton that they were rivals with, and it was just Tupac got himself into something that he shouldn't have got himself into, and he hit a guy that night at the MGM mm-hmm. that he shouldn't have punched, and that guy came back and killed him.
Hmm.
2 hours later. So it's kind of, I always tell people, it's what, if you know the case, it's what you always suspected happened. Because
mm-hmm.
this guy, you know, punches a known violent gang member in the face and 2 hours later gets killed in a gang style drive-by shooting. It's not a big mystery over who probably did it. And the guy that he punched was always the prime suspect. They didn't build a case fast enough. He got killed himself before they could, you know, build a case against him. But mm-hmm. yeah, so anyways, one day we'll probably do a show on this, but long story short, there's been some cool articles about it
yeah.
in the UK media, so it's always nice to get press.
And Biggie just got is going to be inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
So, absolutely. And Tupac got it like a couple years ago.
Shouldn't they call it like the Music Hall of Fame?
I think at this point, yeah.
It's disrespect to any artist, but no. It's not, there's, you know.
Biggie wasn't rock and roll.
Whitney Houston isn't either.
Yeah, I was just thinking that the other day. Should be or the American Music Hall of Fame, or not even that, because they get British bands in too. I don't know what you would call it.
Music.
The Music Hall of Fame. But then it's not classical music. They're not going to do Beethoven.
It's not country.
He would call it pop music, maybe.
Maybe.
But then the metal, Metallica would be like, we're not pop music, so I don't know. It's a good question. What do you call it? The Mainstream Music Hall of Fame. That's what they should call it. I guess Rock and Roll Hall of Fame sounds better than the Popular Music Hall of Fame or whatever.
Yeah.
Or whatever else you would call it, yeah.
But it is odd to lump them all together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Whatever. We can solve the problems in the world.
Solving problems on the Dearly Departed podcast. Any other news?
I don't think so. I think that we didn't talk about was the cause of death for Superman.
Oh, yeah. The guy
that dressed
again?
Like Superman.
Yeah, not the actual
Christopher
Superman.
Dennis.
Yeah, that wasn't Kryptonite.
Christopher, we talked about him a while.
Yeah, so Christopher Dennis, just to recap, played Superman in front of the Chinese Theater on Hollywood Boulevard for the tourists. He was one of the characters that was out there that you could... for a tip,
right.
Get a picture with.
Nice
but he
guy.
Was one of the he was one of the mainstays.
He was like
of
one
it.
Of the first mm-hmm. and one of the nicest and tragic because he was a victim of substance abuse. Not, well, he
substance addiction. Yeah. So
and they found him.
He was found head first in there's these big metal. They're almost like metal dumpsters. They're clothing donation bins, and he had rigged away. It's almost like a mailbox. The way the drawer opens, you can put things in, but you can't get things out. But he had supposedly rigged away using like coat hangers and stuff. To drag clothes out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So supposedly that's what he was doing, and he was found face first down in one of those. And so, yeah, the...
suffocation and meth.
Meth.
Yeah.
Yeah, suffocation from his chest, getting stuck in the thing and then combined with the fact he was apparently on meth.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, that put an end to the, bizarre death of Superman.
You got to stay away from that. Stay away from that kryptonite green meth, everybody. It's a killer.
It's just sad.
Yeah.
Just sad.
It is about as worse of an end as you could possibly have, I would say.
There's help out there.
There is help out there. And guess what, everybody? This is kind of an awkward segue, but
yeah,
we'll do
honestly,
it anyways. Let's do it.
It sounds gross.
It's probably not what they would like, but we have our first sponsor.
We do.
And if I had those little party horns, I would blow one right now. So we have our first sponsor. It is a company called... BetterHelp. If you are an active, that's Better HELP. BetterHelp. If you are an active podcast listener, you probably heard of them. They are. I've heard that they are prolific on podcasts. It's where they like to promote themselves. And basically, it's like a self-help therapy website.
Mm-hmm.
So it's where you can go to get help. You can do it by message. You can do it by video chat or phone chat. And they basically it's professional counseling online.
Virtual counseling. I'm a big believer in therapy. I've done it on mm-hmm. and off for 30 years, and
yeah.
I think it helps you over humps. So it helps people on a daily basis.
How's
or
it
weekly.
Help you, however, how have you found though that
I it was somebody to listen to, and it was actually somebody that didn't give me advice, but made me realize a smart therapist makes you realize through your own thoughts and words of what it is. Just kind of diverts your instinctive thought pattern to go to some place that's more constructive.
Sure.
And I found it
kind of gets you out of over mental blocks. Maybe you're not seeing the forest for the trees.
Yeah. It's not like, thing. Well, now what are you thinking right now? It's not like
and
that.
Analyzing you.
No, they just kind of divert your thought process to make you more, introspective, but in a positive way. No,
it's
I'm
guided introspection almost, I guess, is how it would,
yeah.
in a way, right?
Yeah. Right. Using your own tools, but somehow they're showing you your own tools. So I think that's the thing. It's just so, therapy is important to people that for whatever reason, if it's a, it's a mental health issue, it's an eating issue, or if it's, a loneliness issue, depression, I can't tell you.
Yeah.
Counseling has helped me a great deal in the past.
So BetterHelp is not they're not a crisis line. It's really just a counseling and regular therapy type, like going to the doctor as opposed to calling the ER, essentially. And it's more affordable than doing it in person. You can do it from your own home. You don't have to go to a place and sit in a lobby at a doctor's office and wait to go in to see somebody. And also, if you go to betterhelp.com/dearlydeparted, you get a 10% discount. 10%. You get a 10% discount on your first month. So
thank you to BetterHelp.com for, you know, H-E-L-P for being our first sponsor.
Yes. So BetterHelp.com slash Dearly Departed.
Yes.
Okay. And that's where you go.
That's where you
but,
go.
But I mean, really, if anyone uses this, please, you know, I guess you don't wouldn't want to because you want to be anonymous. But if you, if, I'd be very curious. I'd love to hear from you because and it won't go any further than me. I swear to God. But I'm very interested to know because this stuff's important.
Yeah, it's a nice looking website too. I checked it out.
Yeah.
All right. So thank you to BetterHelp, H-E-L-P for your sponsorship. Thank you for your support. So, Scott, we don't really get hate mail so much as we just get kind of comments.
Yeah. But, curious comment mail.
I guess we'll still call it the hate mail section.
Hate mail.
Okay. But curious mail is probably more like it.
We look at it as hate.
Inquisitive mail.
Now, there's some curious...
What's up?
Well, the two comments that really stood out since the last time made me... It's just... One of them was very funny. And one of them was sort of, okay. Now, the kind of weird one, funny-ish-esque, on Hollywood Death Trip, for some reason, do we cover the Manson murders on Hollywood Death Trip? I don't think we did.
No, we didn't.
So where this comment came from, I don't know.
Yeah, but I don't remember talking anything
the
Manson.
Comment was, Sharon Tate staged her own death. She was seen in Brazil in 1973.
Oh.
It was all a hoax, and I can prove it.
Oh, yes.
So now we know the truth.
Yeah,
that Sharon is living in Brazil.
She staged the deaths of her and what I guess killed four other people to make it believable.
Yeah. So I can prove it. I should actually just reach out and find out exactly how they can prove that. Yeah. I just interesting.
It'll involve dinosaurs on another planet.
Because now there is
some way I guarantee
that chick in Ohio that says she's Sharon Tate's baby.
Yeah, even though she's the wrong gender.
Right.
Yeah.
Well. We think.
It's true. It's all part of the cover-up.
Yep. So the other one was it's on our video that we did in the Wonderland house.
We got into the Wonderland murders house where the famous Wonderland murders happened.
Right. And for you guys, well, it's kind of a complicated story, but there was a drug dealer that got set up by John Holmes, the porn star, who got robbed by a bunch of scumbags that were drug dealers in Laurel Canyon.
And they lived on Wonderland.
Drug dealer found out and had his goons beat up the drug dealer.
And they made John Holmes go with them.
Right.
Because they had a security gate, and I think Holmes helped them get through the security gate. And then into the house.
And Val Kilmer made the movie called Wonderland, starring Val Kilmer as John Holmes.
And they did a hell of a good job recreating
They did. So the house was empty, and I called you, and we went up there straight away. We got the key code and went in, and you were able to film it.
Yes.
We did a walkthrough, and we edited in the actual crime scene footage.
You're right.
It actually is really good.
Yeah, and the crime scene video, I read that the crime scene video of that scene that they shot on video or whatever was the first time that video was taken
by detectives
of a murder scene. Yeah.
Well, it's curious because that particular piece of video is technically owned by us, technically, because it's government property.
Yeah,
it should not have been leaked.
It's public domain.
Right.
So I don't know how it originally got out, but I know it was included as an extra on the Wonderland DVD.
For your entertainment, here are the real victims with their heads bashed
in. Here's one of the most horrible videos you'll
ever see. Oh, my God. I mean, they're literally laying there on the DVD for your entertainment.
Blood everywhere,
So somebody wrote this comment. I do love this. It's genius. The sad thing about this, besides the obvious, is when people who actually knew these people, meaning the drug dealers that got their heads bashed in, when most people who actually knew these people saw this on the news and their first thought was, oh, shit, now I have to find a new drug dealer. I love that. Which is,
just lost my connection, man.
Oh, you know, I'm just saying, we've all been there. Well, some of us have been
there. We've all been there. Oh, man. Oh, I got into... Mae West's old apartment building, Ravenswood.
Did you?
Yes, and I took pictures and everything. I went up to her door and took a picture of her door. And there's an old bench, not permanently attached. It doesn't go with the building. That is right outside her, only her door. It looks of the era, looks like it's probably from the 30s or 40s. Excuse the helicopter going by my window right now, but
are we at war?
Yes, it finally happened.
Are these military ones? Have you seen those lately? There's like three in a row that travel from Santa Barbara down to Long Beach, and it's really, they're just massive.
Oh, it's the big, the Chinooks go over, and then the Ospreys that almost kind of look like planes. They go over a lot.
They're double propeller, huge. Yes. And there are three Ospreys, in a row that just go, it's really wild.
A lot of times they escort, you know, presidents and VPs and other notables like that. Yep. So we got another comment on one of our YouTube videos. I'm studying Manson and the family so I can start it up again.
Okay. Great.
You know what?
You got that.
It's good to have goals.
Good for you. Well done.
And then who was Zuzu?
Zuzu? Yeah, Grimes. She was the youngest actress in It's a Wonderful Life.
So we got one of our listeners said that they had just been at a craft fair in Denver, and she was there selling T-shirts. So there you go. She is doing it.
Yeah, good for her.
They're doing it. All right, well, let's get into the main event, which is...
3 days of peace and love and harmony and
sure. The
Aquarian dawn of that.
Woodstock.
Yeah.
It's time for the main feature.
So this is a lot. It's a lot of people, obviously.
I tried really hard to minimize it or to make it like... Yeah.
I mean, just some of the major bands that were there, as we all know. Richie Havens, Arlo Guthrie, Joan Baez, Santana, Grateful Dead, CCR, Janis, The Who, Jefferson Airplane, Joe Cocker, The Band, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and Young, Jimi Hendrix, and that's like not even half the list of people that were there. So, obviously, you know, it was a long time ago, and not all those people are still with us.
You know, I watched the movie the other night, the director's cut, and it was like 5 hours. And, you know, it was really interesting what they chose to use and what they didn't choose to use. I don't think Grateful Dead even made it into it as far as their music
and
goes.
And also, I don't think they filmed every single thing either.
I think they did.
Because they shot an actual film. I don't know that it was continuously recorded for 3 days.
It was audio, certainly, because that's available
now. Yes, because it's a famous album. Yeah.
But, I mean, it's like 129 hours of it.
Right.
I mean, there was so much of it that, I mean, they had to, you know, film The Grateful Dead. They had, they used two Hendrix songs, two Joplin songs, and they did proper sets. You know, Richie Havens did like 3 hours or something like that. So what they chose to keep in the film and what they chose not to was just curious choices, that's all. If you were buying it for the greatest hits, like you saw Jefferson Airplane, they weren't singing
Volunteers and all that stuff.
Right.
Well,
they weren't showing, you know, Somebody Loved. They weren't showing a White Rabbit. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting just the choices that they made.
Right.
The Hendrix songs weren't the hits. The Joplin songs weren't the hits.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like the anti, you know, if you're really cool, you'll like this album kind of
Here's
a thing.
The B-sides and rarities.
But it was a fascinating documentary. I watched the movie Taking Woodstock shortly before that.
Uh-huh.
And last night I went to see 1917. It was like watching it all over again. Just mud. Just mud.
1917 is my second favorite film of the year, right after Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
It was just mud.
It was amazing.
The whole thing was just cold.
Yes.
Mud.
Yeah.
And it was
It's an incredible film though. Yeah.
Mud. It was a very muddy film. And so
was
Woodstock.
A lot of mud,
Woodstock was very muddy.
Was the 1917 of the 60s.
Oh, my God. Have you ever been to a festival like that?
I've been to lots of music festivals over the years, but never one that got that crazy.
Mud.
I went to a small music festival in high school once that was, it was Lenny Kravitz and Dave Matthews Band and Blues Traveler and Rusted Root. It was very, very 1996. Mm-hmm, and I just remember it was in Park City, Utah. It was on the side of like a ski slope in the summertime, so it was grass, but then it started pouring in the middle of it, and it shorted out the stage during during the headliner, you know, Lenny Kravitz's set. He played like 2 or 3 songs, and then he got really pissed off, and he stormed off, and that was like the end of his set, basically. So that is the closest.
Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of people are out there going, what? Huh?
Exactly. Well, he tried to get us to sing along to a song, but it wasn't one people knew. So it was like, he's like trying to do the clap over the head thing, and like sing the lyrics, and everybody's going like, this isn't one of your big hits.
Yeah.
We're in Utah. And then between that and the stage shorting out from the rain, he just got pissed, and he only played like 3 songs.
You get it. You get wanting to do that.
The rest of the show was great.
It's not very professional.
Dave Matthews was great. Blues Traveler was great. They came out and played together at one point. Like, if you were a music fan in 1996, it was very fun.
But that's the closest I've had to a like a muddy concert experience.
We did, there's a festival every year in Britain called Glastonbury.
Yeah,
and,
huge.
Yeah, and we went one year, and this would have been, like, Blur was there, and Pulp, and mm-hmm. I think Bowie was there, I think. Mm-hmm. But anyway, having a festival in a valley in England was not good. It was very bohemian, but then it started pissing down. And mm-hmm. it was like, we're talking feet of mud. It was miserable. It was, I mean, we luckily we drove there because we were part of the a group of people that are covering it, you know, for mm-hmm. media, but we had to sleep
so
in
you
a
had
tent.
Okay, parking at least or something, right?
Yeah, like, but yeah, it was still like feet deep. I mean, literally by the toilets, you were, you know, the toilets were holes in the ground, and the mud was deep, feet deep in it, and it was just pissing down. We had to sleep in mud, and I finally got disgusted and went and sat in the car. But it was just, we
Hell
had
yes.
that option. These people are out there in tents on the hill in a valley in England where it rains all the time.
Right.
It was just like watching 1917. I felt like I really identified
with
like World
War
One.
You survived the horrors of
Glastonbury. Oh my God, it was so awful. It was just terrible. And watching the movie Woodstock, it just brought it all back. It's like, oh, how horrible was that? Except those people were almost electrocuted. I sound so dramatic, but it was so.
Yeah,
I mean, I like nice clean clothes, and yeah. I like, you know, towels out of the dryer.
At least you've been to Glastonbury, though. That's a big. I mean, that's one of the biggest.
It's a badge of honor.
Music festivals in the world. Yeah,
yeah,
that's way up there. Yeah,
but it was. I would never do it. Never pay it for and buy a ticket and go there. It's horrible.
So who do you want to go over with Woodstock? I mean, there's so many artists.
Yeah.
What stories jump out at you, Scott?
So I mean, basically, it was a festival that happened August 15th through the 18th in 1969 in Bethel, New York. It was supposed to take place elsewhere, and they canceled it. The city revoked their permit, and the guys from New Bethel, which is about 45 miles from Woodstock, reached out and said, hey, we have a permit. I don't know exactly. The movie Taking Woodstock is sort of based on the story, but they had a permit, and they went in and rented the farm of a guy named Max Yasker. And Yasker was just a farmer that lived in Bethel, New York, and he had this farm, and he was also a shrewd businessman, and he offered to rent his land to these guys for this music festival, which was supposed to attract about 50,000 people, but word got out, and it became almost a 500,000 people that showed up in this little town in upstate New York.
And what else is odd about it is, because we have to talk about Manson, this is exactly a week after the Tate-LaBianca murders.
Yeah.
So
exactly a week. Yeah,
exactly
that
a week
Saturday,
later. The
Saturday
following
morning,
weekend, this happened. So it was kind of like the end of the hippie era and the swan song of the hippie era at the same time.
The swan song
of
the 60s,
I think. The 60s, yeah. I would say, yeah. Because, I mean, obviously it continued in the 70s. But
I think, yeah, most people look at it.
It's kind of interesting those happened a week apart.
Most people attribute the Manson murders to the end of the 60s.
Right.
And there's
an
element of
that
because hippies after that were now killers, etc. Mm-hmm. But Woodstock was before it got into a hysteria around the country with the trial and all that sort
mm-hmm.
of business.
Sure.
Woodstock was sort of the last gasp of loveliness.
Yeah.
The people involved with Woodstock, like Grace Slick, you know, she said Woodstock was all right. She says, but the real festival was Monterey in 67. That was the one. Most everyone at Woodstock played at Monterey.
And that's the one that Hendrix lit his guitar on fire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or was it? Was it Isle of Wight?
The Monterey Pop Festival, I think, was where Hendrix lit his guitar on fire, yeah.
So but that was the one that was more organic, whereas Woodstock was set out to be a proper money-making venture. I'm not saying that it wasn't a money-making venture, Monterey, but it was not as financially motivated as Woodstock was. I mean, they had the men with the briefcases and the whole bit. So it was more of a business deal, Woodstock was, than Monterey, which was more of a sort of 67 celebration, summer of love, et cetera.
Yeah.
So it was more of a joyous thing. And I didn't realize that the Scott McKenzie song, If You're Going to San Francisco, that was actually a commercial for Monterey. Monterey Pop Festival. Yeah, that was written by John Phillips.
He wrote that as a jingle?
John Phillips wrote it as to attract people to San Francisco for the Monterey Festival in 67.
Well, I mean, that's like the Beatles Come Together was supposed to be a campaign song.
Was it? I didn't
know that. Timothy Leary.
Really?
Running for governor of California.
Timothy Leary.
Yep.
How interesting.
The great LSD,
yeah,
you know, godfather of LSD trips, basically.
I got to meet Timothy Leary once.
What?
Yeah.
How'd that go?
It was really
okay.
cool.
What happened?
Well,
nice. Is this before or after you took acid?
No, before. So I didn't even know anything about acid.
So you actually met him. Okay, cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it was. I used to work at a theater in Detroit that showed. We had the Ramones, Pat Benatar. There was only a little 600 seat theater.
That's how you met the Ramones.
Yeah, right. And the Undertones, tons of people that way. Devo. Anyway, so Timothy Leary was doing a tour of America as a stand-up philosopher.
Nice.
And I only knew him because he was mentioned in a song from Hair, mm-hmm. and the Moody Blues song, which I still think is one of the greatest songs ever. Timothy Leary's dead. If you're ever doing acid or smoking like really groovy pot or something, put on Timothy Leary's Dead, and it's like membrane. This song is you can melt into it. Anyway. So Timothy Leary was doing this show at this theater I worked at, and that's the only reason I knew him. And he came in and introduced himself to me. And it was only like a, here I am, I got to meet you. I got him to sign my autograph, my Timothy Leary poster. About six people showed up for the show that night, and there was literally nobody there. And he was on stage with a slideshow showing photographs of pills and things. And all I remember is him saying, you know, my wife and I took this before, and we did this. And then this guy came out of the audience and gave him a bong that he made out of a broken bottle. And that's what I remember of Timothy. I was about 18. I was about 18 or 19.
Yeah,
so
you don't know the full cultural significance all the time.
Yeah, but I mean,
it
was Timothy Leary. So I did get to meet him, and I have a memory because I didn't know who he was. And he says, I'm doing the show tonight. I said, well, do you have a ticket or something like that? And somebody kicked me. He said, that's Timothy Leary. Hey, Mr. Leary, hey.
Tune in and tune out, Scott. Come on.
Yeah, turn on.
That's it. What is it?
Tune in, turn on, drop out.
That's what it is. Yeah.
So, but yeah, an icon, and it was really cool. So I didn't realize he was going to run for governor.
Yeah, he ran against Reagan, and that's where Come Together was supposedly written.
And now it's owned by Michael Jackson, who does it for, what's the commercial now? It's an airline commercial or something. I just saw it the other day, and I looked up the ownership, and that's one of the Michael Jackson ones.
One of the ones he got.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How sad. Wouldn't that suck to be Paul McCartney and listen to that?
And Paul McCartney lost Neverland Ranch. Over that as well.
He was supposed to get Neverland?
Supposedly, I read that Paul McCartney was interested in Neverland Ranch, and Michael Jackson talked him out of it. Because that's back when they did, you know, The Girl Is Mine and all that stuff. They were friends.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Jackson supposedly talked him out of Neverland and then bought it for himself.
So,
enough that he got all the Beatles catalog, you know.
And I can't lay blame on that because I don't know the real business behind it. Yeah. But it sucks because Paul McCartney, I mean, it's like Brian Wilson having to pay royalties to sing his own music in concert. It's just like, oh, my God.
Yeah, it's
how
fucked
insulting.
Up. Yeah.
And but that's, you know, business is business, John. Yeah. Or Paul. Isn't that what it was? Paul, business is business.
You do an excellent Michael Jackson impersonation.
That wasn't who I was doing. So, but yeah. But poor Paul McCartney. I mean, granted, he's not suffering at all. But,
of course
but
not. He's had a charmed life.
But at least have to say to what came out of you, you know, your creativity, which has got to be some kind of like a child in a way, to be able to have some sort of say-so of what happens to it. It's like the Doors. You know, the Doors, everything they did was the four of them had to agree. Every single thing.
Oh,
and if
really?
One of them disagreed, they wouldn't do it. And they'd been offered to use the Doors music in advertising. And, you know, Ray and Robbie were into it.
Huh.
But John Densmore said no. And so they couldn't do it. So everything was done democratically with the Doors.
Wow.
And just sort of.
Well, I guess then there's not disputes.
Right.
Later on.
Right.
I didn't want to do that anyways.
Yeah.
You know, you guys
just
never do my
we're
ideas
in this together,
or whatever.
Equal.
Yeah.
So,
right.
But.
Paul McCartney, I've seen him play a couple of times now from like. A mile away.
Yeah.
I've never been close to the stage when he played, but he seems, and I've seen videos with him and stuff, and he just seems like a cool.
One
of those guys
yeah.
that seems like how I would be if I was in his position. Just
did
like,
you see?
Just having fun and enjoying life, and not a dick. You know, not
right.
known for being a jerk. You know, Joe Walsh is kind of that way too. Joe Walsh, and there was the big Eagles documentary talked about, you know, when the Eagles were fighting and breaking up. And Joe Walsh is like, dude, you guys know how lucky you are? Like,
mm-hmm.
you're fighting over the pettiest stuff. You're living the dream. Like, just enjoy it. And I feel like Paul McCartney kind of had that same outlook. You
did
know,
you
that
see
positive.
The James Corden trip to Liverpool with Paul?
Yeah, where they went to the old house.
Oh, my God.
It was
and then people started getting word that he was there.
Paul
McCartney was there.
Up.
So they showed up to his house, and they showed up, you know, the old Cavern Club or where it used to be.
He played it, and he did a show, like, in that little bar with
well,
like
that
50
was the
people.
Thing. He didn't tell anybody. And everyone's in this pub just having beers, and somebody, and is it James Corden? Yeah.
Yeah,
he said to somebody, go put a quarter in the jukebox and play something, Beatles or something, and then the curtain came down, and it's this little pub, shitty little pub in Liverpool, and all of a sudden, freaking Paul McCartney. I still got chills. The hair standing up on my arms just telling
the
story.
The reactions of people sitting at their tables.
And
like,
people
what?
Running in off the streets. I know it was TV. I mean, of course, it was all set up and people were told about it. But or maybe I like to think that it worked out the way it was. But God, it was magical to watch him go back to Liverpool and then do that weirdo concert in that shitty little pub for all those Beatles fans.
Yeah.
How cool was that?
My favorite thing was him going to his house.
Yeah.
And talking about them sitting around.
Sitting in the toilet. And stuff. Or is it, you know, in the bathroom, closing the door where the acoustics were. Yeah, that was interesting. Yeah. That was so good. I love Liverpool. That was really, I love the Beatles. It took me a long time to like the Beatles, but I really do just love them.
All right.
And they were invited. They were invited to Woodstock, but they chose not to.
Play.
There's a lot of bands who said no. Bob Dylan, who lived right there, said no.
It's too cool for school.
Right. Yeah. Chicago, Led Zeppelin. Most of these guys had other gigs, or they double booked. The Doors, Tommy James and the Shondells, Love, the Moody Blues, the Rolling Stones, Simon and Garfunkel, Frank Zappa. And this is the most interesting of them all. I mean, I love all those guys, or a lot of them anyway. But they tried to get Roy Rogers to come out and sing Happy Trails, to be the last guy on the stage.
Awesome.
And his advisor said, no,
you don't
that's
want to be
not a good idea.
Associated with
but
this.
Would that have been something to see him come out in his cowboy nudie suit and sing Happy Trails? That would have been really... Because the thing about this, people saw it as a bunch of dirty hippies, and literally dirty hippies because of the filth. But even everyone in Woodstock, or everyone in New Bethel where this was done, has said, you know, they all say the same thing. You never heard more people saying please and thank you. You never heard more yes sirs and no sirs than you did then. Sure, they had their social issues. They were protesting the war, and a lot of the people there were older conservative people, so they didn't believe in each other necessarily politically, but there was respect for each other.
Sure.
And you know, it just seemed like it was a different time.
Yeah.
And people were kind. Even if you didn't agree, people were kind to each other about it. And I don't know. It just seemed like a really...
There was no internet yet to make everybody hate each
other. That's true.
So.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so it said about 400,000 people showed, I think, is ultimately what they planned. It was going to be a paid event. It was. And people were scrambling for tickets.
But people kept sneaking in and climbing over fences.
And it was a safety issue. So they went, oh, it's free now.
Yeah.
And
it's famous on the recording. You hear them go and make the announcement.
Yeah.
From this point on, this is a free concert.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if they don't, there's going to be serious trouble.
Yeah.
But I think that, but the people that claim, if the people, everyone that claims to have been at Woodstock was really there, you could feel the living room at the Tate House.
There's a billion people. I was there, man.
There were two deaths at Woodstock.
Huh.
One person had an insulin overdose, and another person died, was run over by a tractor.
Wow.
And then there were, I believe, four births. Births and four miscarriages.
Who the fuck is 9 months pregnant? Like, let's go to a muddy music festival.
Dirty hippies.
It'll be beautiful. Yeah. And then there's also, wasn't there a thing in the recording, like, don't eat the blue acid or something like
that?
No,
it was brown.
Acid, yeah, like, stay away from that.
The announcer, who ended up just being the announcer at the last minute because they didn't have one, his name is Chipmunk.
They didn't have an MC.
Chipmunk, M-O-N-C-K. And he's the one that did the famous announcement, stay away from the brown acid. It's too good, is what they said. And he says, I'm not telling you not to do it, but just stay away from it or something like that. And it was announced that it was a special announcement. The brown acid was not poisoned. It was just manufactured poorly. It's not poison. So if you feel like experimenting, only do half a tab.
Oh, all right.
So
there
were two announcements made, but the first one was stay away from the brown acid.
It's telling people how to do their drugs.
I know. But the box office, they made the announcement. The announcement was, box office people, go to the main box office. We don't need you anymore. And that's when it became a free-for-all.
And so who died?
It was, well, it, there was a someone that got run over by a tractor, someone who overdosed on insulin. And there were two births and four miscarriages during the festival.
You know, I almost wouldn't mind that being my legacy, that I was run over and killed by a tractor at Woodstock.
I would rather say born at Woodstock.
That's cooler.
But
that's a good point.
But, yeah.
But run over by
a... You gotta say there's a curiosity there.
Yeah,
I mean, you're
gonna
go.
And that person had relatives that probably told that story for the rest of their lives. Oh, yeah, Uncle So-and-so, he's the guy that, you know, got run over by a tractor at Woodstock.
There you are. Wouldn't that be something? Something to talk about. It's just that you're not around to enjoy it.
Quick side story. You mentioned Bob Dylan a second ago, and they just announced that they are doing a new Dylan biopic focused on when he went electric. And Timothy Chalamet is going to play Dylan, which I think is going to be phenomenal. Because
mm-hmm.
Chalamet is an amazing actor, and he will nail Dylan
mm-hmm.
very well. It looks wise, you know. So I'm pretty excited about it. It's about the controversy around Dylan.
Yeah,
you know, when he went from acoustic to electric guitar. So, yeah.
Yeah, that was a big deal. Mm-hmm. Did you see Echoes in the Canyon?
Not yet. You watched it finally, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah.
It was
all right. Jacob Dylan. I really liked his music. You know, uh-huh. he was singing the old hits, probably because they didn't have the rights to, you know, play those songs because mm-hmm. it would have been really expensive. So there was an element of, I'm sure, residuals.
Yeah.
But I liked their music. I thought it was pretty good. If you're going to have not sing the originals, I thought they were pretty good. I liked it. And he looks a lot like his dad.
Yeah.
He really does.
Mm-hmm. That's a one hit light, right? That's that song. That was his big. That was Jacob Dylan's big hit, wasn't
know.
It?
No, I don't even know Bob Dylan music. To be honest with you, it never spoke to me.
You were never a Bob Dylan guy.
Never.
You
never.
Know, is it just folk music in general that's not yours, or do you just don't like Dylan's? Doesn't?
It's not my thing.
Did you ever see A Mighty Wind, Christopher Guest?
I don't recall. I did see it, but
so,
I don't recall it that
so
well.
It's so good.
I should see it again.
It's so funny. It's classic Guest, you know, and it's the send up of the folk music scene. It's hilarious. It's the siren is on us, guys. It's not in your car. Don't
That's
worry.
That's horrifying. If you're ever in a car and you hear that on a radio,
on a radio
it's scary
you
as
do.
Shit.
You were like, where the fuck is it coming from? I don't see it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's us, guys. Sorry.
Let's let it go. It's probably my house.
We got the honks. It's a fire truck's going to your house. When you hear the honks, that's a fire. You know, it's a fire truck.
This is really happening. but you know, when they did make it a free concert, they just said, what the hell? And the bands after that had to be brought in by helicopter because they couldn't get them to the stages.
You couldn't get through. It was gridlock.
And they brought in medical helicopters too for the people that needed medical treatment too. I don't want to say triage because that sounds like people were dying there, but they had medical treatment. Military were coming in, and it was really an interesting time to see law enforcement and military, and they were all sort of aligned at that point.
Right.
You know, it didn't seem like there was a whole lot of judgment. Although when the military did fly in, they made an announcement. Don't worry, they're working with us. They're cool people. It's mm-hmm. all good.
Also, from a law enforcement standpoint, you got 500,000 people.
True.
What are you gonna do? Like, you can't. You can't do something that's going to start a riot with 500,000 people.
Yeah.
You're outnumbered, so you got to be cool about it.
What an amazing time socially that must have been to be right there, right then.
Yeah, especially to have been behind the scenes.
And to have the ticket stubs.
Oh.
You know?
I know.
Especially the ones that showed up after they made it free, so they're probably unripped tickets.
And then, you know, the album cover, the famous album cover for Woodstock had that couple, that famous photo of the couple standing together under the blanket.
In the mud.
On the last day and just surrounded by just...
garbage.
All the craziness of it. So that couple had been dating for only a couple of months. They are still together to this day. They got, I don't know if they're married, but they are together and have had a whole life together. And it's crazy they'd only been together like a couple of months.
You couldn't break up after that, could you? It's just a reminder. It's
like, right?
No, but that's quite lovely. I mean, there are some really iconic moments in that concert that showed up in like Life magazine. The nuns with the, you know, one giving the peace sign, and there was the cop with the flower with the flower in his helmet. Mm-hmm. And there's some really, really iconic moments.
Yeah.
And that is probably so. You know, the album cover, my God. In the movie. Did you see Ang Lee's movie, Taking Woodstock?
No.
It's so good. I saw it. I watched it again the other day.
It's all about them going out and negotiating the deal with the farmer. Right?
Yeah.
To use the land,
It's
right?
about a kid whose parents own a motel down the road, basically. And he sort of convinced the promoters to come that way and introduce him to Max. So he was sort of, they say, the catalyst.
The go-between, yeah.
Yeah. And this movie, it was so... I don't know. They did everything, but it was never like a mocking thing. It was it. So there was never a moment of watching this movie. Usually you can look at it and go, oh, these are, you know, kids being 60s kids. Mm-hmm. It was really done well. Oh, never great. For a moment did I think that it wasn't the 60s while I was watching it.
Yeah.
And they've demonstrated almost every iconic photograph, even if it was in the background. And it was really done
That's
well.
Cool.
And there's just the kid, the main kid, who was like sort of... Throughout it, he's trying to get to the concert, even though he lives down the road, and he keeps getting sidetracked. And there's a point. Emil Hirsch is in this movie too. He
yeah,
plays
that's
a,
right.
the Vietnam guy that came back shell shocked from Vietnam. Uh-huh. And there's a point where he gets scooped up by this couple in a VW van, and they take him in the van, and they give him a tab of acid. And it is, John Waters said this recently too, it is like the best demonstration of an acid trip or a mushroom trip you will ever see is this moment where he's letting loose, you know, letting himself go in the back, in this van, a protected environment.
Yeah.
And all the colorful posters and the wallpaper in the van that was, you know, it's crazy patterns just started coming to life. And then he looked out at the crowd of Woodstock and it was just like this ocean of people, literally. It was so good.
That's awesome.
It was really well done. I like the movie. It was never making fun. It was just really well done.
Great. What's it called again?
Taking Woodstock.
Yeah, all right, put it on your list, people. I'm going to.
Yeah, it's very good.
This episode brought to you by the makers of Taking Woodstock. No. So okay, I was just gonna say one more thing on the album cover, people. They said that the photo is great because it shows the beginning of their life together. Basically, this
document. I mean, who has that?
As one of the most famous album covers in history.
Yeah.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Who is who you got next?
So I started it by going in order of people who were on stage.
Okay.
And then I started cross-referencing with who was actually there by watching the documentary.
Uh-huh.
And it was all over the place, and it really surprised me. So originally, when I started these documentation of it, I was going piece by piece by person. Mm-hmm. And then I just said, screw it, because some of these vans, you know, I mean, I'm not saying they weren't worthy, but it was just, it got to be too big,
yes.
You know, after 5 hours.
Yeah, yeah,
so,
yeah.
And there was a, I'll tell you some of this is a Swami. I'm going to bastardize his name. Satchidananda
sure.
is his name. He did the welcome.
Uh-huh.
And then Bert Sommer, a folk performer, did about 40 minutes. He went on to be Captain Cool in the Kongs on 70s television, Sid and Marty Krofft show. It was supposed to open with Richie Havens.
Oh, okay.
And he was late.
Mm.
And I believe they brought in this other guy. And then Richie Havens came in second after that. Mm. Ravi Shankar was another one. The Hindu Indian who really was brought to America by George Harrison.
Right. Yeah.
And he played the sitar for about 40 minutes in the rain. Just people really embraced Indian music, East Indian music at that point because of George Harrison.
Yeah, because the Beatles did. Yeah.
Right. And it's interesting because Ravi Shankar, yeah, he played Monterey. I had nothing but great memories.
Yeah.
Woodstock he didn't care for because it was more associated with drugs.
Yeah.
And his music was more about religion than faith than it was for drugs. So he did not care for the association that he had with Woodstock.
And the psychedelic lifestyle and all
right.
that stuff, yeah.
And Ravi Shankar died in 2012 after heart valve replacement.
That's right, I remember reading about that, yeah.
Tim Hardin, who wrote If I Were a Carpenter, which I thought was a Johnny and June Carter Cash song originally, but it was a Tim Hardin song. It was also covered by Bob Seger and Rod Stewart. And he died. I have to do more research on this. He died of an overdose in Hollywood in December of 1980.
Hmm.
Canned Heat played Joan Baez, like you mentioned. Melanie, who wrote a song about Woodstock afterwards, of course. But she became more famous and pop radio for Brand New Key.
Which was used very well in Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, probably one of the most iconic performances at Woodstock was Country Joe and the Fish,
mm-hmm.
because he did the song, it's called I Feel Like I'm Fixing to Die Rag. And most people know it as the Vietnam song, which is that 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't
right.
ask me, I don't give a damn.
Mm-hmm.
Next stop is Vietnam.
Yeah.
And we're all, you know, whoopee, we're all going to die. He actually was sued. There was actually a 1926 song That's, really? It's said, 2-3, what are we fighting for? Huh. And I forget the name of the original song. Ain't no time to wonder why we're all going to die. No, it was the 1-2-3-4 bit. But anyway, the daughter of the man who wrote it sued in 2006 for copyright infringement.
I love when stuff like that happens like 50 years later.
And that's exactly what the judge said. Exactly, you had 30 years to do this.
There's a statute of limitations on intellectual property law theft. So, I mean, for movies, it's like 3 years.
And the family had to pay him like $300,000 in legal expenses to reimburse him for that, so for this lawsuit.
Well, my favorite recording was Coming into Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. That's on all my regular playlists and everything. The Arlo Guthrie Coming in Lies is such a good song, you know. basically flying into LA with a suitcase full of drugs. It's such a good song.
Well, he's still alive and kicking, isn't he?
Arlo?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Joan Baez is, Melanie is, Country Joe is, Santana, John B. Sebastian, Keith Hartley, The Incredible String Band, Canned Heat, Grateful Dead, Creedence, as you mentioned, The Who played a lot of Tommy on stage, and they're one of the bands. There were two bands, I forget who the other one was, that stood backstage and said, "We're not doing this until we get paid." And they were, you know, they just weren't going to get paid. They I guess the promoters were doing that to the artists.
Yeah,
and it's like, oh no, we'll get to you later. And I said, no.
Well, and it was a very, I mean, the promoters were hanging on by the freaking seat of their pants this whole time. And I think the bands figured, like, hey, how are you paying for all this?
Right.
At a certain point,
like, there were a lot of paper bags of cash, I think, and you know, I mean, really,
no doubt, yeah,
and.
No doubt.
So, but yeah, the band's just going, no, we're not going on. And there's like, meanwhile, there's...
It's funny it was The Who, because I just read recently that I think The Who are not happy about all the marijuana smoking at their concerts now.
Really?
Yes.
They have respiratory issues now or something.
What's the deal? No, I don't
know.
Did
you ever see Tommy on Mushrooms? See the movie. Oh, my God. You'll lose your mind. You cannot not have taken psychedelic drugs and have made that movie. Seriously.
I've heard that about Cats, the new Cats movie.
I heard that's horrifying on drugs. I heard that is one of the scariest things you'll ever see on drugs.
Yeah, oh, here it is. Roger Daltrey of The Who hits out at marijuana smoking fans. This was back in May.
Really?
Last year, yep. He is apparently not happy. Cursed out pot-smoking fans. For the second time in recent memories, he chastised fans who were smoking marijuana near the stage.
Okay, well, maybe it's a smoke issue with him.
Maybe it is.
I understand it to a degree. I was at a show one time. Katie Lang stopped a show. This is back when you could still smoke in indoor theaters.
Uh-huh.
And she said, come on, you guys, I cannot sing with all the smoke.
Right.
So The Who had been playing outdoor theaters mostly. So.
Well, and I remember when I was at Lollapalooza 95, Courtney Love stopped a set to yell at guys in the front that were apparently splashing beer on her.
Well,
and she was
that was just a day of work for her.
She was like, if you splash one more drop of that liquid on me, I'm going to come down there and kick your fucking ass or something like that. It was pretty.
Oh yeah,
it was pretty rad.
Oh, didn't somebody throw a shotgun shell at her once?
I can't remember.
Yes, it happened.
I gotta give '90s Courtney Love credit because her voice was freaking strong, and her big debut album, which came out not long after Kurt Cobain died, it's a really good album.
Is that the one Malibu
on it?
And her
voice is awesome. No, that's her follow-up album she did a few years later.
Yeah, that happened one time where someone threw a shotgun shell on stage. It wasn't that the concert, but she's like, whoever did that is the most despicable human being, and she walked off the stage.
Wow.
And and at that point, I can't say I blame her. That was just a straight up insult. And how do you go out? How do you make up after that? I guess you're supposed to be a pro and get over it, but my God, you know, how insulting, how terrifying, how not even potentially terrifying, but it was making a statement about Kurt, not her.
Yes.
And just
right.
awful, awful.
Yeah, that's
awful.
Not fucking cool at all.
No.
No, her first big album, or at least as I know it, her first album was called Live Through This. I read a biography on Cobain and Nirvana called Come As You Are. It's really good by, I think, an old Rolling Stone writer who followed them around a lot. And he said that Kurt and Courtney met at a party, and Courtney was playing at the party, and Kurt thought she was terrible and told her so. And that was the beginning of their relationship, basically. He thought she sucked.
Let's make a baby.
Do lots of drugs together.
You treat me like shit. I love you.
I saw her at the Arclight a few years ago. I don't know why she was there. It must have been some screening, but she was standing in kind of the restaurant area by the kind of hostess station there. She was standing there talking to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she was Courtney Love.
I like wacky Courtney.
Yeah.
You know, I like when she was throwing shit at Madonna when she was doing an interview. They were like in Times Square or something.
Right. She's, like, she's throwing shit up at her. She's like up on the platform.
I love that. Madonna's being interviewed and Courtney's just throwing like shoes at her or something.
Courtney Love, when she got into acting, was in the, you know, the Larry Flint movie and was in Man in the Moon and all those. That was fun.
Yeah.
Flynn Courtney.
She wasn't terrible.
No, she was a good actress. Mm-hmm. She was nominated, I think.
Better than Madonna. Right?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God, yes.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That causes physical pain.
Also, I don't know if we've talked about Courtney Love before, but I think in the 1987 teen rom-com, or I guess dramedy maybe, I don't know. Is it Some Kind of Wonderful? Some Kind of Wonderful. With Eric Stoltz and Mary Stuart Masterson and Leah Thompson. So I was watching the end credits for that movie one time, and as one of the party-goers, because there's a big house party at the end.
Yeah, I remember.
And one of the party-goers is the credited, the name is Courtney Love, one of the actresses. It could be just a random other person with the same, it's not that uncommon of a name, I guess, but I do know that she's supposedly been wanting to be an actress going back to her early years.
Mm-hmm.
So it very well could have been. I would love someone to ask were you an extra and Some Kind of Wonderful with Eric Stoltz?
Yeah, I would totally ask.
Were you
that.
At that? Yeah, were you there at that?
I would totally ask.
Because there was a Courtney
Love
credited.
Were you a stripper at Jumbo's Clown Room?
Yes. All right. Oh, man, I love our tangents.
Right.
What else?
Jefferson Airplane.
You know who was not at Woodstock? Courtney Love.
Maybe she was born in a mud puddle in Woodstock, which would explain
so many things.
Yeah. Jefferson Airplane played. Joe Cocker played. Who was... You know, he died of cancer, lung cancer, in 2014. I mean, that guy was riveting to watch.
Yeah.
You know, I liked him okay as an artist, not a fan.
Mm-hmm.
I saw him, actually, I did end up seeing him in concert because he was backing up Steve Miller once.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it was weird. It was weird, but an odd pairing. But Joe Cocker was, he did A Little Help with My Friends, which is, of course, his most famous song for the Wonder Years theme song.
Well, and if you've ever seen the documentary 20 Feet from Stardom, which is one of my favorite docs ever.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one, they tell a story. I can't remember which big artist it was talking about doing a concert, and they said there was this weird white guy in the front row just convulsing and just dancing weird the whole time. And they were like, who the freak is this guy? And then she's like, a year later, Joe Cocker like blew up, and she realized, oh, that was Joe Cocker.
Yeah.
He was like a huge fan of their music. Yeah.
Have you ever seen Belushi do him? It was fucking great. It was really good.
Just the really contortions good. He would put himself into when he was singing. Yeah.
It didn't look, he looked palsied, you know, which is probably un-PC, but
right,
there
no,
I
that's,
said
that's,
it.
That's,
you know, it just, it was, yeah, it didn't look healthy.
Yeah.
But, so anyway, Joe Cocker, we had, of course, the rain scramble. You know, that was a big deal. People were staying away from the scaffolding because everything was electrified.
And shit's going to fall over, too. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was pretty treacherous. It was really, talk about putting together with, like, scotch tape. And so 10 years after, the band, Johnny Winter, Sly and the Family Stone, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. In fact, that was, you know, the thing about Crosby, Stills, and Nash is that was their second performance.
They were super nervous, too, and I think they even said so.
They said, this scares the shit out of us.
Yeah,
it was the only time they ever performed together twice. That was their second.
And it was there.
So it was, Sha-na-na is the one that is like, really? Sha-na-na played Woodstock.
Why not?
You know?
Yeah.
I guess they were going to get Roy Rogers.
Yeah?
But Sha-na-na.
There's something for everybody.
Yeah, for
bring,
sure.
Bring your parents.
And of course, what topped it off was Hendrix, and the Star Spangled Banner,
and a lot of people don't know. A lot of people left by then.
Yeah, they stayed and they went, oh, we saw them, and they, like the first song came out, and because it's interesting about the documentaries, they show them playing, but on the other hand, they're just showing like this field of garbage.
Yeah, just blankets left behind and stuff. Yeah,
I don't know if that was really at the time.
I think he did. He was kind of over.
Yeah,
for the most part. Yeah,
people were just like, we are done here. It's been 3 days, and it is the end, and we are out because they just saw the traffic.
We've run out of brown acid. It's
awful.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's so uncomfortable to watch. You know, during the whole, they did a group yoga session.
Oh yeah,
from the stage.
Oh, that's
yeah,
nice.
Yeah, that's kind of cool.
That is cool.
Get the deep vein thrombosis out of your system. But obviously Woodstock. Now I believe that the promoters of Woodstock were going to move on to. It certainly legitimately happened in the 60s because I think it was the last significant event in the 60s. But Altamont, I think the same promoters were trying to make a big deal on the on the West Coast.
Oh, okay.
And Altamont, the Stones concert, which was genuinely a free concert, huh, that they were going to do in Golden Gate Park, but they revoked the permits, and they ended up doing it at the Raceway, the Altamont Raceway.
Who the hell, after looking at footage from Woodstock, would be like, oh yeah, use my place?
Yeah.
You know what
yeah.
I mean? Like,
and then
oh,
they hired the Hells Angels to be the security guards, you know? I mean, that was, the announcer got a pool cue cracked across his face and lost his teeth, you know? I mean, it was just a whole different vibe. They were trying to capitalize on Woodstock, but it was just not something that that worked out well. And that was in December of 69. So I think that was the real, end of the 60s at that point. The magic was kind of gone already after 67. Woodstock kind of put it in its mystical place, and then Altamont just kind of thud. There goes the lid on the casket of the 60s. Mm-hmm. Chipmunk was one of the promoters, as was Michael Lang, who promoted Woodstock. There were two hit and runs and one LSD drowning and a stabbing, very famously, the stabbing of a man named Meredith Hunter. And that's what Gimme Shelter, the documentary, is all about. It was during the concert. This guy is on film getting stabbed during the concert.
Oh, wow.
And that's what made Altamont notorious.
Yeah.
So, and Chipmunk's still alive, actually. He lives in Australia, and he sells professional lighting. It's still what he does. Richie Havens, the guy who opened Woodstock and did the 3-hour set, he died in 2013 of a heart attack in New York, and he had his cremains scattered from an airplane over the field where Woodstock took place.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which I thought was kind of neat.
That is cool.
I would certainly do some of that. And not all.
A little bit here, a little bit there. Yeah.
But also, that's still an empty field, but there's a museum there called the Museum of Bethel Woods that it is strictly, to commemorate. There's a lot of electronic stuff. And I'm a big fan of pushing buttons, putting on filthy headphones in museums. I want to see
standing,
stuff.
Listening,
We're at the Musical Instrument Museum in Phoenix, and which is an awesome museum if you ever get a chance to go to. I've never heard of it before.
Yeah.
And they have Daltrey's costume, or his what he wore at Woodstock.
Oh, right.
The fringed blue suit that he wore at Woodstock was there. They had some cool stuff scattered around the country. But the Museum of Bethel Woods in Bethel, New York, has a Woodstock Museum at the location, or as close as they could.
Yeah.
And there is a large monument there commemorating the event, too. So,
any deaths you want to talk about? Any other deaths?
I got nothing.
Did we cover it all?
I think so. I mean, we all know what happened to Jerry Garcia and
Jimi Hendrix.
And Hendrix. And Janice overdosed in 1970 at the Highland Gardens. You can still rent a room, ask for it.
You can go to Barney's Beanery where she had her last drink.
Yep, and see your name scratched on the table. Johnny Winter's gone now. And David Crosby has gotten about three lives, three organ transplants or something. You know, talk about some chemistry in that group, man. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. There's some hate. There's some deep-seated hate in that group.
Yeah, there is.
And Crosby sounds like he was a real dick, but I don't know. When you're the goods, I guess you're temperamental and you're an artist.
Yeah, I actually saw Stephen Stills a few years ago play a show at in L.A. for Autism Speaks, because I think he has a son with autism, I believe, or something like that, anyways, it was interesting because Neil Young played, and they played together toward the end, and it was really interesting because Stephen Stills was a bit of a grump through the whole concert. He was just kind of a grumpy guy. It's kind of a grumpy old guy, and he at first there were some audio issues with his mic not working when he came out to talk, and then it started working, but he didn't know it was working, so the whole time he's talking, he keeps berating his sound crew for his mic not working, but we're all like, we can hear you. Just fine. And then what was really funny was Neil Young came out. Neil Young's the opposite. Like, Neil Young's seems to be very happy being Neil Young, and he came out and he was great, and they played a little together, but Neil Young kind of ribbed him a few times for being kind of grumpy old man.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was kind of interesting.
Yeah. Young is a... just the fact that they were Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, then Crosby, Stills, Nash, then Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young.
Right.
It was such a... it's exhausting. They all sound like they're exhausting. And
there's a bunch of egos together. In a
room. And they were the goods. There was lightning in a bottle for a short period of time. Mm-hmm. The whole... I would recommend the Echoes in the Canyon movie. It's very...
This is on Netflix, right?
Yeah, it's pretty good. But but yeah, so I guess that's it. We talk more about the conscience than the people dying, and but they're pretty well covered. I don't know. It's just such a. It was interesting. Last year was the 50th anniversary, and it was just an interesting. You know, people. It was just an iconic thing in the 60s. I mean, it's always referred to, but to actually delve into it for the other night for like 6 or 8 hours of watching that and then watching the movie, it was really fascinating to get a real what I feel for it as far as sitting in a television living room in a nice warm place, you know, watching it from comfort zone. But you know, it was an amazing thing to watch and people getting together like that. So yeah.
Well, thanks again to BetterHelp.com, BetterHelp.com, and BetterHelp.com/DearlyDeparted is the URL for being the first people to support us financially. So
and they can support you emotionally.
And they can give you emotional support, exactly. Yeah. So thanks again to BetterHelp. And next time we're doing SNL. Saturday Night Live, right? Is that the plan?
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. I guess that's what we're doing.
Come on, we're going to go into Phil Hartman and all of them. All those crazy
Gilda
stars.
And
Gilda, yep. And Belushi, yep.
Cool.
So, all right. So, until next time, everybody. Peace.
Bye now.
Bye.
Bye now. Bye now.
This has been an episode of the Dearly Departed Podcast. Dig up more episodes at DearlyDepartedPod.com and on iTunes and Google Play. See you next time.